Welcome to the Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays read by Leighton Pugh.
China's born-again imperial state and the old challenge it faces. Jonathan Fenby. China is famed for its imperial state, stretching back more than two millennia from its overthrow in 1912 to the first emperor. With its system of civil service examination, rotation of officials, and Confucian values, it is often held up as a model of its kind, a civilization state resting on a culture whose longevity is regularly extended for political purposes. Enthusiasts for the way the modern People's Republic operates proclaim that the last major state ruled by a communist party has inherited the meritocratic model in a system of governance that outstrips anything practiced in the messy democratic West. This line of thinking is naturally embraced in Beijing, where Chinese values are extolled and Western values depreciated, even if Marx's profile still adorns the Great Hall of the People, and the Republic's president Xi Jinping sent his daughter to Harvard until it became impolitic to do so. Han nationalism feeds into the creed of exceptionalism dating from the first emperor through rulers who declined to receive foreign ambassadors for fear of giving them the idea that their barbarian states might be on a par with the Zhongguo, or Middle Kingdom. China is held to have been a unitary state under the descendants of the Han Yellow Emperor when Europe was rent by wars of the Dark Ages, and if dynasties changed, that was because the occupants of the Dragon Throne had proved unworthy of the mandate of heaven, leaving all-embracing belief in the system intact. The vast non-Han territories of Xinjiang and Tibet are depicted as integral parts of China, and the mainland proclaims its right to use force if it wishes to regain Taiwan in the name of the One China policy, which Donald Trump transgressed at his peril at the start of his administration before falling into line with Beijing's wishes. As with other myths that congregate around China's history, much of that is questionable, to say the least. China was repeatedly invaded and divided, at one point for three centuries. It came under the rule of the Mongols, while the Qing, the final dynasty who took the country to the apogee of its wealth and power, were from Manchuria. The great Qing emperors of the 17th and 18th centuries knew the benefits of enlisting the Confucian civil service to run the Middle Kingdom for them, and so followed Chinese rituals. But they regarded China as only one part of an empire stretching to Mongolia, Tibet, and Xinjiang, and kept up their shamanic rituals from the northeast behind the walls of their palaces. Nor was the Chinese bureaucracy quite the meritocratic example it had been made out to be. The famous state examination to select the civil service was tilted in favor of the well-off. In the later stages of the empire, degrees could be acquired by services to the state or simply payment of money, rather than through intellectual excellence. The expertise in set texts required for advancement was hardly a seeding bed for new thought. Keeping the system going was the paramount aim. The magistrates who administered the vast country on behalf of the ruler were too few in number to apply government effectively and were often corrupt. Local interests often predominated. The emperor was respected so long as he was on the other side of the mountain, as the saying went. As for Tibet and Xinjiang, they were not really part of China, and existed for long periods under autonomous rulers. At one time, it was Tibetan raiders who threatened northern China, as did other marauding tribesmen from the steppes. Incorporating the two territories into the People's Republic required military campaigns, and the central government continues to face deep-rooted opposition from the native population, with self-immolation by Tibetan Buddhists and recurrent outbreaks of violence from the Uyghurs of Xinjiang. The most widely accepted historical estimate is that around the year 1800, China accounted for a third of global wealth, though one more recent study casts doubt on how far the Middle Kingdom was ahead of Europe at the time. Its empire certainly did not match those of Britain and other powers from the other side of the world in geographical scope. The lengthy voyages of the Ming Admiral Zheng Hu in the 15th century were very much the exception. The emperors required obeisance from regional neighbors, but their sway did not cross oceans. China was a land power set in its context between the Pacific and Central Asia. It traded more widely, but as a state, its reach was geographically limited and its culture self-sufficient. Its emperor felt so confident that he rebuffed a mission sent by Britain's King George III because its leader, Lord Macartney, declined to go through the required kowtowing ritual, saying his country had no need of the mechanical toys the barbarians brought. 3 decades later, in the name of free trade in narcotics from India and to redress a trade deficit and drain on silver reserves, the British returned with their steamships and routed the Imperial junk fleet on the Pearl River in the First Opium War. That began what is known as the Century of Humiliation, in which the decline of China through the 19th century is attributed to rapacious foreigners. That narrative is based on the solid fact of the unequal treaties which gave the British and then other Western powers what amounted to sovereign rights in major cities such as Shanghai, Wuhan, and Canton. But this reading ascribes too much influence to the barbarians, predatory though they undoubtedly were. The decline was caused much more by internal factors, the weaknesses of the ruling system, and above all a series of huge mid-century revolts, notably by the Taiping, whose leader imagined himself to be the son of the Christian god, and who aimed to overthrow the foreign Manchu in the name of Chinese Han civilization. The revolt lasted for 15 years and spread all over southern China, taking millions of lives and causing widespread devastation, while concurrent revolts in the east and west of the country strained the imperial resources to breaking point. To defend itself, the Qing delegated authority to regional gentry leaders and their armies, thus undermining their own central power and increasing the decentralization of the state. Government finances came under growing strain. The Dowager Empress, who ran the court, put the interests of the ruling Manchu clan above those of the country at large. Industrial and economic modernization were shunned as threats to the status quo on which the dynasty rested. A crushing defeat by Japan in the War of 1894-1895, followed by an abortive reform drive, and then the Boxer Rebellion, spelled the end of the Manchus, as the rulers became the target of growing Han chauvinism. The revolution of 1911-1912, which overthrew the Qing, was supposed to have ushered in a new era, but it represented a change of ruling class rather than a wider-reaching transformation of the nation. The imperial state was destroyed, but there was nothing to take its place. The leading revolutionary, Sun Yat-sen, dubbed the Father of the Republic, turned out to be a singularly inept figure and resigned the presidency after a few weeks, ushering in military rule and then warlord anarchy on a national scale. The May 4th modernization movement of 1919 proclaimed the need for China to have a Mr. Science and a Mr. Democracy, but its impact outside the urban intelligentsia was very limited. The nationalist government established in 1927 after Chiang Kai-shek had defeated or bought off the warlords began with many grand plans for state building, economic development and reform, but little of this was realized. The Nanjing regime's authority never reached beyond the central Yangtze River basin. It faced a regional revolt practically every year, and the Japanese grabbed Manchuria in 1931 and then launched 8 years of full-scale war, while Generalissimo Chiang sought survival in what has been aptly described as Confucian fascism, marked by ineffective government, rising corruption, and the Generalissimo's preference for loyalty above ability among his ministers and generals. As soon as America had defeated Japan, China was plunged into civil war between the government and the communists. Elections, held under a new constitution in 1947, were limited mainly to the ruling Kuomintang Party. In 1949, Mao led the People's Liberation Army to victory and proclaimed the People's Republic. Accompanied by widespread violence, suppression of opposition, and the burnishing of the cult of Mao, the PRC did fill the vacuum of the state, which had been evident since 1912 and had been aggravated by the long war with Japan. Mao remarked once that without that invasion, the communists would not have won power. The Marxist-Leninist-Maoist ideology and its egalitarian narrative, along with such traumas as the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, gave the impression that China had changed forever, that communism, as defined by the Great Helmsman, had taken over for good. This impression was shaken in part by the launch of economic reform by Deng Xiaoping in 1978, but the economy could be regarded as being in a box of its own, leaving the post-1949 political structure intact. That, I think, is to misunderstand what has happened, and is still happening. Today's China is, I suggest, best viewed as a prolongation of the imperial millennia, with 1949 marking the establishment of a new dynasty. Communism conquered China in 1949, but China has now conquered communism. Mao was in the mold of dynastic founders dating back to the first emperor. Late in life, he likened himself to his far-off predecessor, and his wife liked to dress up in costumes of the fearsome emperor Wu Zetian, the only female emperor. The way he saw the Chinese as just so many numbers was in line with Qing, whose mania for standardization stretched to insisting that all cart axles be of the same length. His taste for vast infrastructure projects using manual labor were in the direct line of the founder of the Great Wall. Both believed in their own infallibility, and Mao boasted that he had eliminated far more opponents than the unifier of central China. In this compressed replaying of history, Deng is the clever successor who saves the dynasty from the damage done by the founder in his later years. In 1989, the empire faces an internal challenge, but puts it down ruthlessly, and there is then a period of relative calm, in which China establishes external links and concentrates on building prosperity. But it comes at the cost of weakening the ruler's grip, and allowing decentralization of authority accompanied by rampant corruption under a weak collegiate leader. That takes us to 2012, when a new strong figure emerges in the shape of Xi Jinping, intent on strengthening central control by varied means, building up the armed forces and expanding China's influence abroad. One-man rule takes over. As Xi goes into his second five-year term, later in 2017, the state over which he presides is best seen as a prolongation of the imperial system in which the mandate of heaven is made secure through the emperor who incarnates the system. In place of the factionalism seen under his predecessor, the courtiers have a sole master. The very partial separation of powers envisaged by Deng is being steadily reversed, whether in politics, the economy, the armed forces, or internal security. Ideological conformity is used not for its philosophical value, but as a means of regimentation, rule by law, much beloved of the first emperor and not to be confused with rule of law, is used to enforce central control. Having disposed of obvious high-profile foes, an unprecedented anti-corruption campaign is pursued to dragoon officials and state enterprise managers into line. A personality cult has been erected around the man on the throne. The first such campaign projected a folksy image of Xi and his singer wife as a devoted couple depicted as cartoon characters. But something more serious was then needed. So Xi's increasingly imperial persona is on clear display from grand parades in Beijing to Davos and Mar-a-Lago as he seeks to put in place a new version of the imperial tribute system through such devices as the granting of aid under the One Belt, One Road program and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. At the same time, he is extending sovereignty claims and moving into vacuums left by the other major claimant to international influence as Donald Trump pulled out of global engagements. As so often with personality cults, the ruler who is its object operates in opaque fashion. Media are strictly controlled. Deliberations in the leadership compound by Beijing's Forbidden City are cloaked in secrecy. Pronouncements are handed down like the scrolls from the gate of the imperial palace. Dissent is equated with treason. Only a few months before the key five-yearly party congress, the likely membership of the Politburo Standing Committee remains in the clouds. The government has clearly been demoted in decision-making, but nobody knows quite how vital choices are made. What we do know is that the current dynasty rests on the Communist Party as its organizing base. The party permeates China from the Politburo down to its cells in sports clubs. It has made sure that it faces no real opposition. The current persecution of human rights lawyers shows the depth of the insistence on eliminating any form of real or potential dissent. Since the suppression of the 1989 protests, that power base has been consolidated on the basis of a bargain with China's 1.4 billion people. Leave the politics and government to us, and we will make sure you grow materially better off. But growth is slowing as the Deng-era combination of cheap labor, abundant capital, a low starting base, and buoyant export markets weakens. And the growth of the economy throws up increasingly complex challenges, be it in a debt burden that has reached 260% of GDP, capital controls, the real estate market, or shadow banking. Pollution of air, water, arable land, and food stirs growing discontent. The second generation of the middle class are less amenable than their parents to control, as they use social media in their hundreds of millions, travel abroad, and adopt foreign modes. The demographics are going the wrong way as the population ages and the demographic dividend erodes. China's attractions as a manufacturing base dwindle as costs rise and onshoring becomes more attractive for foreign firms. At the root of the one-party state power structure, the need to buttress control is the bottom line for Xi, as he has made evident from the moment he took command of the Communist Party at the end of 2012. China has never had a peaceful change of regime. Its only quasi-free election in 1912 ended with the leader of the winning party being assassinated by agents of a general who then took over. Control exercised by force is embedded in the Communist Party's DNA, as it was in most imperial dynasties. This means that the state is limited in the reforms it can accept, since these would threaten that control. But without reforms, the regime risks losing the momentum that has powered it over the last three decades. This is not a new dilemma. The late Qing dynasty faced the choice between adopting Western technological modernization and maintaining the court system. They chose the latter. The leaders running the Chinese state today are going to face a similar choice over the coming decade. I have little doubt they will follow the example of the Qing, which is why I think that for all its material progress and ability to shock and awe, China is not going to rule the world. The imperatives of its new/old state holding it back, just as was the case for the empire that prefigured today's China.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.